Can you see that? They didn't. Okay. And in the same way, no two children of the same parents. The reason no two children of the same parents is because the parents will have different circumstances at the time that they're born. That the boys, that the kids are born. Number one, the parents' relationship might be different. The stress on the parents might be different. Also, of course, the birth order has some impact, so that I didn't have to share my mother's attention with anybody, but my brother never had that one-to-one relationship that I had. On the other hand, my brother never experienced the insult of losing that number one status and now all of a sudden having to share it. Whereas, you know, it took me, I was 40 years old when I think first forgave my brother for being born. If I still have, that is. Secondly, as the British psychiatrist D.W. Winnicott pointed out, even if the mother could be the same mother to all eight of her kids, she couldn't be, because by the way, each child evokes something different. So it's not that you love more or that you favor one more than the other, but they just evoke some different reaction in you because they trigger different parts of you. But he said that even if a mother could be the same mother to all eight of her kids, those eight kids still all have the eight different mothers because they have different sensibilities. So they experience the parent differently. So no two children have the same childhood. And no two children have the same parents. And this is true even of identical twins.
Well, let me just emphasize that although I'm giving you ADHD as an example, it's only that. It's only an example. The same dynamic apply whether we talk about childhood depression, anxiety, autism, bipolar, and so on. And I'll say something very specific about the bipolar illness, because a lot of kids are not being diagnosed with bipolar illness at age 6, 7, 8, and 9. And I'll be saying to you, just as I said about the tuning out of ADHD, the bipolar diagnosis is not a medical disease. It represents temporary states that become traits. And they're adaptive states. Actually, bipolar, when you look at it closely, is simply an adaptation that becomes wired into the kid. So it's the same dynamic. As soon as I say something is not genetic, people say, well, are you saying it's not biological? I'm not saying that. What I'm saying is it is biological, but the biology is not caused by the genes. And how that works, I'll tell you very shortly. For example, if you do, there's one brain scan score, one EEG study. EEGs are electroencephalograms. They're the electrical readout of the neurological activity of the brain. Where in one study of ADHD kids, they looked at adolescent boys with and without the condition, and they did EEGs, you know, the electrical wave pattern of their brains, at rest. And at rest, you couldn't distinguish the two groups. But then you gave them a math problem. And in the non-ADHD group, you have, in the front part of the brain, increased fast wave activity, so more brain activity, which is what you expect. But in the ADHD group, you had increased slow wave activity. So the brain actually shut down in response to the math problem. That's a biological effect. By the way, what's causing it? Stress. So the more you stress these kids, the more you shut their brains down. So when they act out and they behave in certain ways you don't like, or when they're dawdling around their homework and you get tense and you start yelling at them, what you're actually doing is you're shutting down their brains. So that's biological. And then similarly in adults with ADHD, they've done brain scans, and again, the same story. Look at blood flow and energy uptake in the front part of the brain. It's normal until you give them a challenge, and then it becomes diminished. By the way, they found the same pattern, brain scan patterns, in violent criminals. Which tells you something about the nature of violence, that at the moment of violence, probably, person is stressed, and the front part of the brain, the decision-making part of the brain, is shut down. I'm talking about impulsive violence. And actually, when you look at the jail population, a significant percentage are diagnosable with all kinds of disorders like ADHD and other conditions of impulse regulation. So there's something biological going on here. The question is, what causes the biology? Now, what I didn't know when I was first diagnosed myself, I understood that the tuning out wasn't a disease. That much I already knew. But what I didn't know is what I'm about to tell you next. And what I'm about to tell you next is, again, it's not controversial. Scientifically, it's been completely validated. Nobody argues about it. And yet, medical students are not taught about it, nor are psychologists or educators. And it has to do with the development of the human brain. So it turned out that the development of the human brain does not happen strictly through genetic influences, but happens under the impact of the environment. So brain development, which circuits develop and which do not, has to do with the kind of environments that people have, particularly the human brain. Now, if you look at a horse can run on the first day of life. It comes out of the womb and a few hours later it's running around. Humans can't muster that neurological coordination, balance, visual acuity until a year and a half, 2 years, which is to say the horse is 18 to 24 months ahead of us in terms of brain development. So that the brain development that in other animals occurs largely in the relative safety of the uterus, and I say relative safety of the uterus because it's not 100% safety, but the relative safety of the uterus in a human being has to happen after birth and not before. We're born with the smallest brains in relation to the adult brain and the least developed brain than any other creature. And so the first few years of life are a period of rapid brain development. By the end of the third year of life, the human brain is 80% adult size. The human body is only 18% adult size. So it's a rapid and sensitive period. And there are times in the first year of life when the growth is so rapid that in every second, so in this space of time, you have about 1 billion connections being made. And the human brain is the only one that for a while continues to grow at the same rate outside the uterus as inside the uterus. And that depends very much on conditions. So to give you an example, if you have a child whose genes are fine and has got perfectly good eyes at birth and has got some rudimentary vision, and you put him in a dark room for 5 years, he'd be blind thereafter for the rest of his life. Because the 30 circuits that together comprise the visual apparatus require light for their development. In the absence of light, the brain basically says, there's nothing to see. Why should I put any energy into developing light waves? Besides which, the presence of light waves is required for them to develop. So that energy that goes into touch or hearing or taste or smell rather than vision. So the light is necessary for the development or the circuits of vision. So that's shaped by the environment. It's not determined by the genes. Now, as to why the human brain is so susceptible to the environment, that has to do with evolutionary logic. And these days, 21st century United States, it's controversial to talk about evolution, but some of us still believe that it's a scientific fact. And what happens, of course, is that if you look at our evolution, the ancestors, what gave rise to the impetus of the human brain is the use of the forepaws as hands and the digits as fingers. So as we began to do this and to hold objects as tools and to manipulate the tools, eventually start making tools, the brain has to get larger and larger to plan and modulate and coordinate all those activities. So you're getting a larger and larger head, you see, particularly the forebrain and the prefrontal cortex, the part of the gray matter that is the most sophisticated and the most human part of our brain apparatus. Our head's getting larger and larger. But in order to make full use of the hands, we start walking on two legs. And in order to walk on two legs, the pelvis has to get narrower because, you know, it's difficult to walk on two legs with a very broad pelvis. So what you're getting is a narrower pelvis and a larger head. You know what the upshot is if you've given birth. Which is that already at birth, the head is the largest diameter of the human body. If anything's going to get stuck in the birth canal, 80% of the time it's going to be the head. So with the relatively narrow human pelvis and large head, we can't wait any more than 9 months to be born. If we waited till 12 months, we would not be born. So the brain development that in other creatures occurs in the womb, in the human being, has to happen afterwards. So we have to be born with premature brains. So basically, we're born prematurely. Now, that means we're more susceptible to the environment, because more of our development happens on the outside. 80% of the brain development occurs after birth. 80% of the size increase in the brain occurs after birth, and probably 90% of neurological development happens after birth. And the human brain is the least mature of any mammal and stays that way, so that our brain development occurs over a much longer trajectory than that of other animals. And throughout all that time, we're susceptible to the environment. And furthermore, as I already showed you this morning, our biology is very much affected by the environment for all of our lives. So the UCLA psychiatrist, Dr. Daniel Siegel, talks about what he calls interpersonal neurobiology. So that the biology of the brain and the nervous system is interpersonal, which means that it's social. Now, somebody asked about, does this process begin in the uterus? Yes, it does. As the California, the Stanford-based psychologist Robert Sapolsky says, we're affected by the environment as soon as we have an environment. And when do we have an environment? As soon as we're implanted in the mother's womb. From that moment on, we're affected by the environment. So when women are stressed, their embryos are stressed. Their fetuses, their developing infants are stressed. So after 9/11, when some women, as a result of the World Trade catastrophe, experienced post-traumatic stress disorder while they were pregnant, 1 year later, their infants had abnormal stress hormones. So the child's stress regulation was affected by the mother's stress during the pregnancy. This is probably a lifelong effect. In a British study, mothers who were abused by their partners while they were pregnant had higher levels of cortisol, the stress hormone, in their placenta, and at 7, 8 years of age, their kids were more likely to be diagnosed with all kinds of disorders. In a recent study, women who underwent stresses like problems with an older child, like relationship issues, like economic struggles, the more stresses accumulated in a mother during pregnancy, the more likely their kid was to be diagnosed with behavior problems at age 3 or 4. You can stress pregnant animals in the laboratory just for 10 minutes a week, expose them to a lot of noise. And their offspring, when they're adults, are more likely to use cocaine and alcohol. So already pregnancy has an impact. Which, by the way, then, tells you right away what's wrong with the genetic studies. How do you do genetic studies anyway? Like, how can you tell if something is genetic or something is environmental? Well, you look at family history, right? So parents are alcoholics, the kids becomes an alcoholic, or the parents have ADHD, the kids have ADHD. It's got to be genetic, right? But only if you're not thinking. Because, for example, let's say you're an infant mental health specialist, and your son or daughter becomes an infant mental health specialist. Does that mean that the specialty of infant mental health is a genetic disease? Or is it possible that certain conditions led to similar lines of development in different generations? So something running in families tells you nothing about whether it's genetic or not, because you don't know whether you've recreated the same conditions or not. Well, then you look at adoption studies, right? When children adopted, they come from the same parents, but they're brought up in different families, then surely you can say that the environment is different, but the genes are the same. Now, you can only say that in the case of identical twins, by the way. So the hallmark of genetic studies is that adoption studies using identical twins. So you take identical twins and, you know, they're adopted to different families. Whatever is similar about them has got to be genetic, so was the argument. Whatever is different has to be environmental because they didn't share the same environment, but they do share the same genes. When you look at such studies, then if one identical twin has alcoholism or ADHD or autism or anything else, the other one is much more likely to have it as well. You get a concordance rate, you know, or similarity rate, it's like 60-70%. So you think, oh, well, this has got to be genetic. But the fact that it's 60-70% already tells you that it can't be purely genetic, can it? Because if it was purely genetic, if one has it, so should the other, because they have the same genes. If they don't, it can't be all genetic. But secondly, is the assumption that these identical twins adopted at birth to different families have different environments, is that valid? It's not valid as if you realize that those infants developed in the same uterus. Now, any woman that's going to give up a baby for adoption is by definition a stressed woman. It's because she's stressed that she has to give up that baby. She's a single mom. She's an abused mom. She's a poor mom. She's a teenage mom. She's an addicted mom. Something's going on. So for 9 months, the hormones of stress, particularly the cortisol, is going through the placenta to those two infants. So it's not true they didn't have the same environment, number one. Number two, at birth, instead of bonding with the mother, they were both separated from the mother. Well, let me tell you about the impact of that. There was a study at McGill University in Montreal with rats. Now, mother rats, in fact, all mammalian mothers, when the infants are born, engage in a bonding ritual with the infant. The bonding ritual in the case of human beings is that the infant is placed on the mother's belly even before the cord is cut, actually. contrary to medical practice. And the baby actually migrates towards the breast and latches on and starts sucking. Purely an instinctual bonding ritual. Now, in rats, the mother licks the baby on the perineum. The perineum is the anal genital area, and that process of licking is called grooming. Now, some other rats groom their infants, this is in the first few minutes of life, in a more nurturing fashion. The mothers that groom in a more nurturing fashion than some other mother rats, their infants, when they grow up to be adults, are less anxious, are smarter, they're better able to find their way out of the maze, they don't get distressed. And if you autopsy them, their brains, in a certain part of the brain called the amygdala, they have more receptors for the brain's natural tranquilizing chemicals. You've heard of the benzodiazepine drugs? The benzos are drugs like Librium and Valium and Ativan and Cirax, Oxazepam, you know, these are the the brain has natural benzodiazepine tranquilizing chemicals. And these brains of the rats whose mothers licked them more in a more nurturing fashion, they have more receptors for this internal chemicals. In other words, they're calmer. Now you might say this is a genetic effect, so maybe the same mother rats who are calmer, they just gave birth to calmer rats, but it's not true, because if you take the infants, the pups of mothers who groom well, and you put them with mothers who don't, they grow up to be more anxious with fewer receptors in their brain. So the biology of the brain is affected by the first few minutes of contact with the mother. And similarly, if you take the rats of mothers who don't groom so well, but you put them with mothers who do, they grow up to be calm with lots of receptors. So the brain biology of the adult is actually affected by the first half an hour or so of contact with the mother. Does that also true in human life? Well, probably not to the same extent as in a rat, because a rat is a much rapid, shorter course of development and is not as complex psychologically as a human being is. But that's not to say that that contact in human life is not important, which brings us to the medicalization of childbirth. Like what happens in a culture, like in Canada, and I'm sure the statistics are at least the same here, where you have a cesarean section rate of over 30%. And that early bonding does not take place because the mother is too sick or too obtunded after the anesthetic. And the infant is whisked away to the special care nursery. But we don't have that contact. And just the artificial conditions in which we deliver babies. Women are, instead of encouraged to relax, they're monitored, they're maybe because of type or looking for something that can go wrong. Women don't have the kind of support that women used to have with other women around in a supportive community atmosphere. For all our technological advances, which are wonderful, we've also really undermined that mother-infant bonding and a healthy, relaxed way of childbirth. So when you look at these twin studies, you see, they ignore all those factors. So it's not true that these identical twins separated at birth did not share the same environment. And by the way, has anybody ever looked at ultrasounds of twins in the uterus? What do you see them doing already at age 8, 9 months? Yeah, they are contacting each other. No, they lose that contact. They don't only lose the mother, they also lose the contact. And you might think, kids don't recall that, but they remember it. There's a kind of emotional memory without recall that I'll tell you about later. So you might not recall what happened to you at birth, but you remember it. It's in your body. Or any child separated from the mother at birth doesn't recall the separation, but he or she remembers it. And how does she remember it? By the sense of rejection that they experience in the womb. Adopted kids, by the way, have double the risk of suicide. They have a significantly higher rate of diagnosis of all kinds of childhood conditions, including ADHD. And adopted people will tell you that they feel very easily rejected, abandoned by others. Well, that's a memory. It's a memory without recall, but it's an emotional memory. And that's why these adoption studies are not that helpful in separating what's genetic and what isn't. Now, to go back to brain development then, if what happens in the uterus is important, well, what happens after birth is also important, because that's when the brain is largely developing. So if you take, you know, as I mentioned, the light waves. Now, the circuits of vision need light for their development. The circuits of impulse regulation, of attention regulation, of social cues, understanding, which is missing in autism, missing in a lot of these childhood conditions. The circuits implicated in addiction, as I'll tell you this afternoon. All these brain circuits also need the right environment. And the necessary condition for the development of these crucial brain circuits, and I'm talking about their biological development, is the presence of
non-stressed, non-depressed, emotionally available, consistently available, attuned parenting caregivers. So the necessary condition for the development of these crucial brain circuits, again, is the presence of non-stressed, non-depressed, emotionally available, consistently available, attuned parenting caregivers. So anything that interferes with the parent's capacity to manifest those qualities for the child will actually interfere with the child's brain development. So at the University of Washington in Seattle, they did EEGs, again, electroencephalograms, of the brains of six-month-olds whose mother had postpartum depression. And they compared them to the EEGs of infants whose mothers did not have postpartum depression. And you could tell from the EEG of the child whose mother was depressed and whose wasn't. The electrical activity of the child's brain was affected by the emotional states of the mother. And we're not talking about bad parenting. We're not talking about mothers who didn't love their kids. We're not talking about mothers who didn't do their very best for the child. We're talking about mothers who were too depressed. Because the studies more recently have shown is when parents are stressed, they can't tune into the emotional cues of the child. Not because they don't want to, but simply the depression and or stress gets in the way of that. Now, when I talked about me crying a lot on the second day after the Germans invaded Budapest, what was I reacting to? Not that my mother didn't love me, but her tone of voice was different. It was tense. How could it be otherwise? Her body language was rigid. Her face was sad. If you show babies photographs of women with dilated pupils convey invitation and joy, babies start smiling. But they won't if you show them women with small pupils. So children respond to the size of the mother's pupils, which represents the mother's emotional states. Again, the tone of voice, the body language. Is it relaxed or is it rigid? These are the things that affect the brain development of children. And these are not factors that parents do or do not do deliberately. It simply reflects their emotional states. So mothers with postpartum depression. Now, according to American studies, 20% of women these days suffer postpartum depression, and 40% have some symptoms of it. If you look at the infant children of women with postpartum depression in the child's first year of life on the part of the mother, and then you measure the stress hormone levels of the child at 3 years, it's still elevated, it's still abnormal. And postpartum depression in the mother is a significant risk factor for developmental problems in the child. Because the depressed mother can't interact with the kid the way she would like to. So again, the more we stress parents, and there's many, many such studies. So in the same Harvard's paper in the Journal of Pediatrics of 2 months ago, what did they say? The architecture of the brain is constructed through an ongoing process that begins before birth, continues into adulthood, and establishes either a sturdy or fragile foundation for all the health, learning, and behavior that follow. The interaction of genes and experiences literally shapes the circuitry of the developing brain and is critically influenced by the mutual responsiveness of adult-child relationships, particularly in the early childhood years. Toxic stress in the early years can damage the development of the developing brain and other organ systems and lead to lifelong problems in learning and social relationships, as well as increased susceptibility to illness. And as I quoted to you before, Dr. Daniel Siegel, he says, human connections create neuronal connections, so that the relationships actually program the nervous system of the child. And as Dr. Robert Post, chief of the biological psychiatry branch of the National Institute of Mental Health here in the U.S. said, at any point in this process, you have all these potentials for either good or bad stimulation to get in there and set the microstructure of the brain. And as another brain researcher here in the States says, environmentally induced deficits include a reduced ability to anticipate consequences, or to inhibit irrelevant or inappropriate self-destructive behaviors. And humans and other animals demonstrate severe disturbances in all aspects of social, emotional, expressive, and perceptual functioning. So
So that's the story. And then you say, well, okay, you've got ADHD, and you've explained that by means of the terrible circumstances in your first day of life. What about your kids? So my kids were born in Vancouver, British Columbia. Stable. No, you know, it's not a violent society there. It's not a threatened society. Except last year when the Vancouver Canucks lost the Stanley Cup Finals to the Boston Bruins, and there was riots in the streets of Vancouver, you know. But that's about the only time. And my wife and I have been married 42 years now. 43 this year. And, you know, there was no substance abuse or, you know, when the kids were growing up or at any time throughout their childhood or later. There was no violence in our home. I did have an anger problem. Why did I have ADHD? Well, because when my kids were small, I was a workaholic doctor. And that meant that I was always on the beeper and energized and happy when I was working and delivering babies and running to the emergency ward and all the stuff that I was doing. And that means emotionally I wasn't available for them. Because when I was at home, I was an addict in withdrawal. I was irritable and I was listless, didn't know what to do with myself. I didn't know how to be present. Beeper went like a drug. Why was I a workaholic doctor? Well, what message did I get when I was 1 year old or less than 1 year old? The message I got is that the world didn't want me. No, that's not because my mother didn't want me, but she wasn't happy around me. She was stressed and depressed, as you can imagine, with the absence of her husband, the death of my grandparents, the daily threat to our lives that persisted till I was a year old. She was a very depressed woman, highly stressed. It's not enough for the mother to love the child. She also has to be joyful and happy around the child for the child to get the sense that he or she is wanted. Because we get the sense that we're wanted when our parents are happy and joyful around us. If they're not, we get the sense that we are failures, that we are not wanted, that we're not worthwhile. Which is the last thing that the parents want you to feel. But the child can't help but interpret the world in that particular way. So I very much got the message that the world didn't want me. Now, what better way to compensate for not being wanted than to make myself needed? And what better way to make myself needed than to become a workaholic doctor? Now I'm going to be needed all the time. Everybody's going to want me. And this beeper's going to go off all the time to tell me just how wanted I am, how needed I am. So they may not want me, but they're going to need me, which is the next best thing. So now I'm a workaholic doctor, which means that I'm not available emotionally to my family, and my wife is stressed as a result. She goes into a bank or supermarket and shows her credit card, and, oh, are you the wife of Dr. Matte? Isn't he wonderful? And she's gritting her teeth. Because the wonderful doctor is not so wonderful at home. So she gets depressed. Now what message do my kids get? Same thing. How do their brains deal with it? By tuning it out. Now they're diagnosed with ADHD. And I didn't pass it on genetically. I just passed it on, unconsciously. If we look at what's happening in North America now, that's what we're seeing. What we're seeing is a massive stressing of the parenting environment. Because it turns out that the nuclear family was never the proper environment for child rearing. There was a study done at Notre Dame University a year or two ago. They showed that the optimal environment for child rearing is actually the hunter-gatherer tribe. And there are three qualities that hunter-gatherer societies provide to children that our society no longer provides. Number one, positive contact. So those kids are never put down. There's no separation between the parents and the children. Kids are carried everywhere, like the papoose, you know, the native Indians. They carry the kids everywhere. In Nairobi, Kenya, a few years ago, there's a report I read in the newspaper where somebody opened a baby buggy shop. Wasn't doing very well. So the reporter asked the owner, "So, why do you think your business is not thriving in this busy city?" And she said, she just laughed, and she said, "Well, because the parents here don't get why they should put their babies into a machine. They just carry them everywhere." So that positive contact. Secondly, when babies cry, you know what happens? They get picked up. They're not told by doctors, like I used to tell my patients, until I knew better.
Don't pick them up, that's just going to spoil them. Let them cry it out. Let them learn to be independent. At night, don't pick them up because then they keep waking up. You have to train them to sleep through the night. No, when the baby's crying, you pick them up. Why is the baby crying? Because that crying is a message. The baby has only got one way to hold on to you, and that's through physical contact. So if only through physical contact does the baby have a sense of attachment. Attachment being, me being the closeness and proximity with another human being, which is the crucial dynamic in human life. Now when you don't pick the baby up, guess what you're doing? You're stressing the baby. And the stress hormones overwhelm the baby's brain. Cortisol actually shrinks the brain, certain crucial parts of the brain. So when you let babies cry it out, you're actually stressing them. In fact, babies that are never picked up will actually die. You can feed them and all that, but if you don't pick them up and hold them, they will die. And if you looked at those terrible orphanages in Ceausescu's Romania, when you looked at babies in or infants where the staff to child ratio was so hopelessly low that those kids rarely got picked up, they had very high stress hormone levels. By the way, same thing has been found in American daycares. And I'll say more about that later as well. So when the cortisol levels overwhelm the child's brain, the child's stress regulation doesn't develop very well. That's the second factor. The third factor, this is crucial, is that hunter-gatherer tribes provide to the child not just a nuclear family, but an extended family in a little village, as Hillary Clinton was fond of quoting the African saying, it takes a village to raise a child. So those children had a whole set of nurturing adults' attachments, which meant that there was a deep sense of security in the world. Now what's happened in North America now, of course, is that owing to economic and cultural changes, the extended family's gone for a lot of kids, safe neighborhoods are gone, communities are gone, the parents are isolated, and in many, many, many cases, both parents have to work to make a living. So that means that for the first time in history, in peacetime, most children are growing up away from the nurturing adults in their lives. That's why we're seeing all these childhood disorders. ADHD, autism, bipolar illness and all that. It's not some genetic explosion. Now if you look at the program Sesame Street, just look at that program, you know, which I think began in the 60s, wasn't it? Or late 60s, early 70s? What characterized Sesame Street? First of all, they had these short little segments. So, you know, the letter A or a song about number five and so on. Why did they have those short segments? What was that program designed to do? To teach? To children, well, which children in particular? Well, children with short attention spans. And who were those kids? They were the kids of the inner city ghettos east of the United States. The population where the family structure had been most destroyed. Not by individual choice of the parents, but really by a long history of economic pressure, exclusion, and let's face it, racial oppression. And these are the kids who lacked the attention span. So you had these short little segments. But what else did Sesame Street provide? It provided an extended family, a community. You know, Mr. Hooper, the grocery store, and all the friendly animals, the Muppets and all that. So there was a little sense of community and connection. And the parents, just what these kids in real life were lacking in their lives. Now, Sesame Street really was the first program to cater to the short attention spans of kids very much affected by social breakdown. But if you look at, as I say in my book on ADHD, if you look at a news program from the days of Sesame Street and compare them to a news program today, those of you that have gray enough hairs to remember, what difference do you see? The segments are much shorter now. You see, in those days, when you asked a question, somebody could actually answer it in a full sentence, and even longer. Not now on most TV programs is a sound bite of just 2 or 3 seconds. So we live in a sound bite culture. It's like the whole culture has been sesamized. Because people have shorter and shorter attention spans. There was an article in a New Yorker magazine a couple of weeks ago on the music business. And this producer was saying that you have to hook kids with the tune right away because the average person will listen to a song on the radio for 7 seconds. Then they flip channels. So you haven't hooked them in 7 seconds. They're gone.
People no longer have attention spans. And if you look at the rock videos that our kids are watching, apart from their frankly pornographic content, body parts undulating at you without any context, the camera angle stays still only for a split second. These rapid cuts, I can't even watch them. So that what we've got is an increasing preponderance to short attention span. That reflects the culture, but the culture reflects what's happening. What's happening is that because of these stresses, people have shorter and shorter attention spans. So what we're looking at is a broad cultural phenomenon. We're not looking at a genetic disease here. What we're looking at is a culturally induced and economically induced brain developmental problem. Now, I was asked about bipolar illness, so how does that fit into it? Well, just as that tuning out of the ADHD child is a coping mechanism, so is the bipolar diagnosis a coping mechanism in its original state. What characterizes bipolar illness? Either kind of a manic hyperactivity or a kind of a despondent non-activity. Depression, right? Now, they're just nothing but defenses. The human brain, again, has a number of ways of responding to environmental challenge. The most primitive way, based on our evolutionary antecedents, is the reptilian way. Part of our brain still functions in a reptilian fashion. And the reptilian response to environmental challenge is actually immobilization. When you're mobilized, you use less energy, and you make yourself invisible so that perhaps you won't be seen. And you dissociate. And there's your depressed state. That's one way. The second state is a higher mammalian response to threat, which is hypermobilization. That's the flight and fight response. Now, the reptilian immobilization and the mammalian hypermobilization states, they employ different brain circuits, different brain centers, different physiological responses. But both of them are well programmed into our physiology and in our nervous system. What's bipolar illness except an exaggeration of either immobilization or the hypomobilization state? So again, these things begin as temporary states, but in some kids, if their environment continues to be stressed, they become established as long-term traits. Think of paranoia now. It's a disease. The paranoid thinks that they are being controlled or watched by hostile, powerful forces. So you can see that as a disease. Or maybe you can look at the history of that person and realize that when they were small, they were traumatized. Now, if you're small and being traumatized, aren't you being controlled and watched by powerful hostile forces? Is the paranoia actually dysfunctional, or is it a temporary adaptive state that later on becomes a trait and now it's dysfunctional? So all these illnesses and conditions really are adaptations. Now, if you look at autism, what characterizes autism? The chief characteristics of it is that this is a social disconnect. You won't look at people in the eye, and you won't connect emotionally. That's a protection. You're not going to make yourself vulnerable. So you'll connect to objects or to ideas, but you won't connect to people. It's a fear of connection because perhaps you've been hurt in the connection. So I think if you look at autism, I can't prove this because I haven't studied it, but I think if you look at autism, it still has to do with the stress in society, particularly stress on pregnant women. Now, is there nothing genetic going on in this particular society or in these conditions? Well, yeah, I think there's some genetic predispositions. But a predisposition is not the same as a predetermination. A predisposition just says that you're more likely to have something. But let me tell you something about genes. Dr. James Gilligan, who's a professor of emeritus of psychiatry at Harvard, studied violence all his life. And he talks about an Australian study that looked at violent people. And they found in these people, looked at a population for violence. In the most violent, they found a genetic mutation, which if all you knew was that fact, you'd think they found a gene for violence. Except the same genetic mutation was found in people that were less violent than others.
You have the same genetic mutation, more violence here, less violence here, than in the average person. Same gene, totally different behaviors. What do you think the gene was for? Protection, sensitivity. Because if you looked at the histories of these people, the violent ones have been abused as kids. And the non-violent ones grew up in nurtured families. In other words, they adapted to their environment. They were sensitive. Now, you mind if I hit you?
Well,
okay. Okay. How much did that hurt you?
Nothing.
Did it hurt you at all?
No.
No pain at all. But now if you imagine that your shoulder was bare, and you had a burn on your shoulder, so that your nerve endings are close to the surface. In other words, you were thin-skinned, and if I attacked you with the same force, now what would you experience? Severe pain. So the degree of pain that you experienced would be very different based on how sensitive you were. So what may be transmitted genetically is sensitivity, so that you're going to be more affected by the environment. And I think these kids, the autistic ones, and the bipolar ones, and the ADHD ones, and so on, they tend to be more sensitive to start with. And the more sensitive you are, the less external stuff has to go wrong for you to be affected by it. So that if you look at two kids, similar circumstances, the one is more sensitive. They're going to be more affected. But what they were affected by was still the environment. Because the reality is that genes are turned on and off by the environment. So yeah, there are certain genes that do predispose for addiction, for example. But American studies have shown that even if children have those genes that are predisposing for addiction, if they're brought up in nurturing families, those genes are turned off. Genes are turned on and off by the environment. And that's called epigenetics. That's the new science of epigenetics. Epi means on top of. So what are the environmental factors that actually modulate the expression of genes? The genes don't determine. There are very few diseases that are generally determined. Now, I see that there's an exhibition here now on Woody Guthrie. Woody Guthrie, as you know, died of Huntington's chorea. Huntington's chorea is a genetically determined disorder. If you have the gene for Huntington's, you have a 99% chance of getting the disease itself. But it's very rare. It's like 1 in 10,000. Genetic diseases are very rare in the population. Most diseases are not genetically determined, even if there's a predisposition. So you take something like breast cancer, everybody thinks it's genetic. The heck it is. Out of 100 women with breast cancer, do you know how many carry the breast cancer gene? 7. 93 do not. And even 100 women with the genes, although their risk is much greater, still not 100 will get the disease. So even there, the genes are not by themselves determined. The genes are turned on and off by the environment. I get really bored of the genetic argument. The reason I get bored with it is, even if it's present to a certain degree, what can you do about it? You got it, you either have it or you don't. If something is 80% genetic even, which these conditions are not nearly that, but even if they were, it's still that 20% environment that I'd be interested in. Because outside the fantasies of pharmaceutical companies, it's that 20% that I can work with. I can't work with the kids' genes, they already have the genes. But I can work with the environment. Now the reality is, as I'm telling you, it's vastly much more environmental than it is genetic for most of these conditions. All of these conditions, actually, is the environment. Again, then, the question becomes not how to just treat change behaviors, but how do we modulate the environment in such a way as to promote the right kind of development? Because as I mentioned to you earlier, there's such a thing called neuroplasticity, which is the capacity of the brain to develop new circuits even later on in life. And those were eloquently demonstrated in studies done in at Berkeley, California, by Dr. Marion Diamond in the 1980s, who worked with rats. And she took rats at different ages, newborns and old ones and everything else in between. And she even took some baby rats, newborns, and deliberately damaged their brains. And then she exposed these rats to different levels of environmental stimulation. So some with more social contact and more play and all that. And after a couple of months, they looked at the activities of these rats. Well, the ones that had the better environment, again, I think were better able to find their way out of a maze. And when you autopsied them, these rats at any age Whether they were newborns with brain damage, whether they were old rats, 2 months after the differential treatment, the environmentally favored rats had larger nerve cells in the front part of their brain with more connections to other nerve cells and richer blood supply. In other words, the biology of the front part of the brain was affected by those 2 months of environmental stimulation. And so Marion Diamond said, you never give up on anybody. And she wrote a book called Magic Trees of the Mind, meaning these neurological cells with their many branches, the neurons. So given neuroplasticity, the question again we have to keep asking is, what will promote right development and what will not promote right development? And many of the things we do to control kids' behaviors actually get in the way of the right kind of development. So let me give you an example. So I've said that the necessary condition for development is the presence of attuned, emotionally available, consistently available, non-stressed, non-depressed parents. It's the relationship, it's the relationship, it's the relationship. So you take something like a simple technique like the timeout technique. So you see, there's a book called 1-2-3 Magic by Thomas Phelan, which recommends timeouts. And you basically tell the three-year-old, okay, I'm counting, one, two, you know, and if you're still doing this, timeout. Punitive timeout, which involves separation. Now what are you doing when you're promoting the timeout technique? Well, it works, you see, it works. If you threaten a three-year-old or four-year-old with a timeout, it's going to work. Why is it going to work? They're going to be isolated. Basically, what you're saying to the four-year-old is, kid, I know exactly what your biggest need is. Your biggest need is unconditional loving acceptance from me, a relationship from me. And so, kid, next time you displease me, I'm going to use against you your biggest need. In other words, that's your biggest fear, the loss of that relationship. So you better comply or I'm going to threaten you with the loss of what you most need. Guess what? Yeah, I'll be good. And they promise. And they'll be good for a day or so. Because you've frightened them to death. But what is the message? The message is that the relationship is conditional. That my acceptance of you is conditioned on you pleasing me. Now how would you as an adult like to be in a relationship where your partner says to you, okay, we'll be in a relationship, but only as long as you please me. And if you don't, it's going to be time out. Let's say you go to your friends, you say, you know, my partner or spouse, when they come home from work, they don't want to talk to me and they won't even have a meal with me and they're on the phone talking to other people and they don't want to do things with me anymore. Would your friend say to you, have you tried time out? How about tough love, you know? They'd say to you, you've got a relationship problem, not a behavior problem. That's what we've got our kids. It's a relationship problem, not a behavior problem. Now the timeout simply will get you the behavior that you want, but it completely undermines the child's sense of security. And without that sense of security, there's no child development. Because for development, you need security and safety. Because without that sense of security, the child is either in that immobilization mode or the hypermobilization mode. And these are both defensive states. And a human being can be either in defensive state or growth state, but not both at the same time. There's a third level of response to the environment, which is a non-defensive one. And that's called the social engagement mode. So you got the reptilian immobilization, the mammalian hypermobilization, and then you have the social, the human and primate engagement mode, where your head turns to the other person, your eyes look at them and you capture their gaze and you look at their facial expressions and you listen to the modulation of their voice and you do that in the social engagement mode and that's a non-defensive mode and that's the only mode in which there's learning that happens. Because you're not defending yourself, you're actually paying attention and you're learning. So when we put kids into the defensive modes by our anger, by our punishments, by our timeouts, we're actually destroying their capacity to learn. And then we wonder, how come they don't learn from negative examples? Doesn't matter how many times I punish them, they keep doing the same thing. So when a parent comes and says, you know, I told my kid 1,000 times not to do this, and they still keep doing it, the proper answer is, well, look, if you told your kid 1,000 times not to do it, and they still keep doing it, who's got the learning problem here? Well, you both do. We as parents and as adults, we have to learn from negative example too. We have to get that things are not working and ask ourselves, why not? The reason they're not working is because their kids are not feeling safe. And when I feel safe, they can't develop. I'll take some questions now.
What about when grandparents or parents spank their children? Or, like some grandparents, like mine did, who were born in 1901, they could switch off the tree and you get your legs all switched up because you did something normal.
Yeah. You know, I've often counseled adults who tell me, you know, I was never abused, nothing bad ever happened to me. I said, anybody ever hit you? Oh, yeah. My father would take out the belt when I was, but only when I deserved it. And I'd say, well, how old were you? 4, 5, 6. Now, would you ever hit a 5-year-old with a belt? Oh, no, I'd never do that. Well, why not? Well, actually, what does the 5-year-old experience when they hit with a belt? Pain and fear and terror. And they're getting this from the very person that they're relying on for protection. To be hit is traumatic. Not so much because of physical pain, because of the sense of emotional rejection. I believe it's harmful. And even, you know, I was hit many times by my dad, but it didn't do me any harm. Well, yeah, okay. Maybe you don't think it did. Other questions?
In regards to children with ADHD or ADHD symptoms, we talked about, he was talking earlier about it being due to parents being stressed and the symptoms in there with the parents. If you treat the parent and the stress that the parent has, are you going to see any improvement with the ADHD symptoms of the child?
You know, almost everywhere I travel, a couple of people come up to me and say, you know, I read your book on ADHD when my kid was 7, and it changed our whole relationship. These kids are so sensitive, you see. So when there's a shift in their environment, they're sensitive to that too. So I'm saying, yes, changing that relationship will actually change the child's function. That doesn't mean they might never need medication, but I'm not concerned about that. No, but they're going to relate totally differently to themselves and to the world. And that's what you actually want. So yeah, it's going to make a huge difference. So that it's not the kids who need the counseling ever. Don't make me a 5-year-old for counseling, for God's sake. I mean, if, you know, maybe have them do some play therapy and music therapy, and that's great. Art therapy, that's great. 5-year-old doesn't need counseling. It's the parents who need the counseling.
I was listening to you talk about the cultures where the hunter-gatherer cultures,
yeah,
where children have more support and nurturing from their families, and thinking about some of our programs at Parent Child Center are home visitation, and we are trying to help educate the parents on their child's physical and emotional development.
Right.
And it just made me think of a case that someone staffed with me just yesterday about a child who's developmentally behind, not walking yet, because mom holds the child all the time.
How old is the child?
A little over 1-year-old, yeah.
Well,
and so, you know, as educators and parent support, we're there to help with that balance between positive connection and attachment behavior for that child from the parent, that holding versus developmentally, how can that child meet the milestones that are appropriate for their physical development?
Are you worried that the mother was totally holding the kid when the kid is 20 years old? Is that the fear?
Okay. Yeah.
Look, it depends why the mother's holding the child. There's two reasons why the mother could be holding the child. One is healthy, the other is not. The mother could be holding the child because the child needs to be held and she's meeting the child's needs. But she could also be holding the child too much if the child's meeting her needs, because her attachment needs were not met as a child, and or it is not being met today. She's using the baby as an attachment figure. If that's the case, that kid is in trouble. So it all depends where that's coming from. Now, I don't know if any of you saw a documentary that was quite highly praised a couple of years ago. It was called Babies. They follow 4 babies, one born here in the United States in San Francisco, one born in Mongolia, one born in Japan, and the 4th born in Africa. Now, at the end of the year, so there's no narration in this documentary. You just follow these babies from birth to 1 year of age, and you see them interacting with their parents and other people. At the end of the year, those of you that saw the film, which kid is the most grounded and secure and confident? The African kid is. And why? Because this kid was never away from the mother. Now, it's not that he was always held. He'd be sitting there, but other mothers were sitting around, the whole village was there, and the kids were listening to music together, or the mothers were preparing food, and the kids were there, and there's always contact. At the end of the year, that kid is a warrior, you know, and he's dancing, and, you know. So, it's not a question of always having to be held, it's a question of always being attended to, attuned with, secure. Now, if the child is being held because the mother needs that contact like a doll, that kid is not getting his needs met. So it depends on where that's coming from.
Obsessive-compulsive disorder, does that? I didn't know.
Yeah, okay, sure, OCD. Well, I can say more about that when I talk about addictions, because it's very much related to addictions, OCD is. It's not quite addictions, but it's similar. But in OCD, I believe what's going on is this, that a person has a deep anxiety. Why would we have a deep anxiety? What is our biggest need? Security, emotional security. What is our biggest fear? Like even as adults, never mind children, even as adults, what is your biggest fear? Is it that you lose your job or that you lose your relationship? So that even as adults, those attachment relationships are crucial to us. Well, for the child, they're absolutely life essential. But it's vulnerable to recognize that I'm not getting the connection that I need. It's very painful for a child to say, Mom and Daddy are not giving me the attention that I need. It's less vulnerable to focus that anxiety on something that's physical. So the person with OCD will focus on something like washing their hands 100 times for fear if they don't, somebody will die in their lives. Or they have to check the door 66 times before they leave the house, otherwise something terrible will happen. In other words, the person with OCD will compulsively focus on something that's non-vulnerable as a displacement for the real anxiety, which is vulnerable. So it's a protection against vulnerability. Because you're not going to be hurt by the door not being checked 66 times. Or you're not going to be hurt by the door or by the checking the faucet or washing your hand 100 times. Those aren't vulnerable things. Whereas to recognize that I'm deeply anxious because my attachment needs are not being met, it's highly vulnerable. So the OCD is a displacement of vulnerability from the human to the objective realm.
I've been wondering about, because we do tend to save more babies now, preemies, and even little 1-pound babies.
Yeah.
When you have a vulnerable child, I mean, you've got some, you think some physical or neurological conditions already there, and then what kind of thoughts do you have about those preemies? And those
babies? Those preemies are a risk. Preemies are a greater risk for death after they go home. And this is a Canadian article just last week that I read, that Canada, the rate of preemie deaths was going up. Then they look at Estonia, where they actually cut down the number of preemie deaths, because they don't have the technology that we do. So because they didn't have all the fancy equipment and all that, and all the specialist help available, and all the special nursing help, they had to bring the parents and the families into the hospital to look after these preemies. That also meant by the time they went home, the parents were much more used to dealing with the preemie. And just the contact with the families diminished the number of preemie deaths. Now if you take premature children and they're in incubators, and those that you just stroke their backs for 10 minutes a day, give them their naked skin for 10 minutes a day, they have better brain development than in the older days when they were just left to lie there in those incubators. So that even in that case, those kids are definitely at risk for neurological problems or development problems. They're certainly at risk because, you know, look at all the conditions. I mean, they're brought into the world prematurely before their brains are developed, even to the natural 9-month stage. And then, instead of the contact, they're getting all this machinery and being poked by needles and traumatized. I mean, let's face it, that's a serious... It may be saving their lives, but it's also a serious impediment to their development. But those that you stroke just for 10 minutes a day, they have better brain development. So these kids also need a lot of, as much contact as we can possibly give them.
But that won't be my end.
This show and all previous episodes are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. As always, I hope the show has given you food for thought. If you'd like to discuss its content, you can do so on this show's discussion page, accessible from unwelcomeguests.net/653.
Let go right.